So I really just want to start with, obviously we don't want a full detail right from the beginning, but really more so an overview of your work within the alternative scene now, so your work really. But if you can start on a little bit about your background and then how it's led into basically your presentations and other work.
Okay. Well, I went public in about 2010, 2011. And I used all the media to do that, whether it was the alternative media, whether it was mainstream, radio, television. And what I was saying to people was that my family that I grew up in was what you would call an espionage family. So not a military family or indeed a political family, but an espionage family. So my mother worked for MI5. My grandfather worked for MI6. But within that, it was very much to do what we call the alien agenda. So my mother's job was to type out documents that related to UFOs that had crashed all over the globe. And that was her job from about 1965, 66, till she died in 1979. And obviously, in 1965, I was quite a young boy. So for all of my childhood, that was the environment that I was growing up in. Running along with this were alien connections, visitations, for want of a better word, from off-world creatures. So almost in a way, one paralleled another. And then, you know, you've got to make your way in life, haven't you? And it's a 3D world. And I suppose as a young man, I put a lot of it to the back of my head and concentrated on working and living. And then as I got older, and as the world changed and the world became more and more intolerant, governments became more and more intolerant, and it was becoming very obvious to me that humanity was sleepwalking to disaster, basically. So I thought, well, I need to do something. I've been sitting on this for a very long time. It's too big a truth to keep to myself. I really don't care. I know I'm telling the truth. I'm just going to do it. So went public, went through a huge publicity boom with that. A number of organisations were attempting to write me off as a nut or as somebody who was imagining things. And then, of course, the big game changer was being invited to the secret radar base. And all the mainstream media who weren't supportive were completely dumbfounded. And I had calls here on the phone from media people saying, we don't understand this, you know. this is what they've said sort of off the record, but as long as I don't give their names, I don't see why it's wrong. They said to me, we've spent our careers basically doing what we've been told to do, which is to make fools of people like you. And then suddenly you're being invited to a secret radar base. And they're saying to me, it makes us look stupid. What's going on here? You know, we feel we've been cheated. Never mind me. They felt they'd been cheated because they'd been given a brief to try and make me look stupid. And then the government says, come and have a 3-hour tour around our radar base. And that was the game changer. From that moment onwards, the established media completely changed its attitude towards me. And I did make the point at Marlborough, so much so that when the new incoming Pope made his inaugural speech where he said he would baptise aliens, 6:30 in the morning, who did the BBC phone for the first comment? Me. So that's how it's completely changed, because these guys who are running the media they just don't understand how the game has changed. They don't understand why somebody who purports to having a mother who was MI5 and grandfather MI6 and sees aliens is then being given, you know, very, very special treatment by the military. So that was very handy and very useful. In terms of what I see my role is literally to just tell people what's going on around them, to make people aware that they are being lied to on a very regular basis and have been for years. The information can come from two ways. One would be from manted beings, which I would accept very readily. Less so from the reptilians. The information coming there, it tends, not because they lie to me, but because it's always wrapped up in ceremony, ritual, culture. Often they put a slant on something. whereas the mantids don't have that agenda. So the information coming from the mantids is far crisper. It's probably a better word, and easier to put time, dates, and actions to. Whereas the stuff from the reptilians, you know, they'll tell you something which might have happened 1,000 years ago, but to them it's really important. So it's very, very difficult to discern from that. And what I'll do is I'll balance what security information are telling me against what off-worlders are telling me, and when the two actually match, then I believe I've done a bit of scientific critical work, and then I'll act on that. I used to be an auxiliary lecturer at the Natural History Museum. I did that for a number of years, and my job there was to meet school children from all over Great Britain and their tutors from the age of 5 to 20, and then conduct them around what we call the Earth Galleries, which are the dinosaurs, and I would run workshops. Now, interestingly enough, there, Charles Darwin has a very large statue where he sits on a chair, over life size, really huge. But what people don't know, sadly, is that about 5 to 6 feet to the right of him is a painting of a guy called Wallace. And below that is a small plate which says, joint author of The Origin of Species. But because, you see, Darwin's dad was a 33 degree Mason, and Darwin's dad paid for it all, and the book publishing, the whole world believes in the evolution of species from start to finish. Although when Wallace, who co-authored the book, said he could understand all animals coming through this survival of the fittest, but he didn't accept humans could do that. And they actually fell out over it. Wallace refused to go along with that. But Wallace didn't have any money. And a reptilian agenda is very much the strong will survive. And this is the element that the Illuminati have. If you are the fit, you will survive. It's what Hitler was about. We will create the master race. It's all part of the same grouping. So that explains, first of all, the evolutionary side in terms of the Illuminati. If you go into a genuine Illuminati family house, there are certain books you will find on the bookcase. The Evolution of Species is one of them. So is Lord of the Rings. There are a set number of books you could go in. I mean, I could go into a household and I'd tell you whether it's Illuminati or not, just looking at the books. So that's a very important part to understand. The other part that's very important for people to grasp is that it is just physically impossible for an ape species to go from swinging in trees in 3 to 4 million years to actually driving a motor car. It's not possible. And I would say to people, look at cats and look at dogs. How have they evolved? Do they speak? Do they drive motor cars? Why don't they do that? Look at a chimpanzee. Why hasn't that evolved and why hasn't that changed? Why? What's so special about humanity that's done that? So if you look at Zachariah Sitchin did some incredibly good detective work in deciphering the actual scrolls that came from ancient Sumeria. The problem was that some of those scrolls weren't quite what they purported to be. It is the reptilian agenda, and I'm using the term genetically now, generically now. It's the reptilian agenda to get humanity to accept them as their creators, as their gods. Because if a weakened species, intellectually, is presented with somebody that looks like a god, it will immediately go into the, you're my boss. It's no different from Captain Cook arriving on an island, being the first white man, and firing a cannon. It's exactly the same thing, and that's what they want. The problem is that's not accurate. The story I have from the mantids is that humanity was already ticking along quite nicely, but semi-destroyed itself several times on the way. Then the reptilians arrived, and by a process I don't understand or don't know, enabled to knock out some of the DNA strands that were active in humans. Remove some of their memories and over a period of time genetically alter them so that they were a far less capable species than the creatures that they had originally come and found. So yes, they used monkeys, and in my mother's blood, my human mother's blood was rhesus negative. My human father's blood was rhesus positive. And rhesus blood is very linked to the rhesus monkey. And you will find that any Illuminati person will have rhesus in his or her bloodline, because that is the key link that goes back thousands of years and goes back to the time when humans were genetically altered to make the creatures that we have now. So I don't accept them as lords and gods of humanity at all. I do accept that they genetically altered them. My soul, according to them, is the first soul that inhabited a viable human. That's why they're interested in me. So not humanity, but after they'd genetically altered creatures, and some of the things they made died and didn't last. They just lasted minutes. But the first living bodied creature that came out of the production line had the soul in, and that's the soul that resides in my body now. So now we're now moving on to souls. So we talk about genetics and bloodline, which is the physical part of it. Then you have the souls, because if you believe in reincarnation, which we all should do, because that is the only way it works in the East, they fully understand it. It's just the West that's lost the plot. A soul will reincarnate in an appropriate body. So if you have a soul that, let's say, for instance, inhabited the body of King Solomon, that soul is not going to go into a body as somebody who doesn't have that bloodline. So that soul will find a body that has a suitable bloodline which will be compatible, because if you put a soul like that into a body that doesn't have that, they will reject each other. See, my biological father was Jewish, came from Persia. His family had all been in Mesopotamia, southern part of Turkey. That's where this bloodline comes from. My mother was English. I think she came from Saxon line, so the blonde hair and blue eyes. But my father was very much from Mesopotamia, Persian, Iranian. So that actually is the strong bloodline. So what they've done, in my case, I suppose, with my mother and father, because they would have got together, that will have been orchestrated. You've mixed someone from a Mesopotamian line with a Celtic line and a Saxon line. So that's what they've done.
I just wanted to know, are you familiar with John Rawls' work?
No.
You're not. So the basically, John Rawls, his theory is that an intelligent reptilian being evolved from the dinosaurs.
Okay.
Do you have you any comments on that? Do you think that it's plausible? Is it in your experience and your research, is that something that's plausible?
That's right. That's absolutely correct. This is another arm of them. What I would refer them to now, the subterranean group. These are the group that actually live underground. They're very interesting. They're not hostile to humans directly. They just want to be left alone. If a human was to go down into their caves, they would be very quickly got rid of. But they're not, that particular group are not coming out to make war. They just want to be left alone. You're talking about the Chicxulub meteor struck at about 65 million years ago, which ostensibly wiped out the dinosaurs. But a grouping were already on an evolutionary path before that, and they were the ones that survived in caverns and developed. So yes, I fully accept that.
Are you aware of any contact with government or military?
Government and military do have contact with them, but it's not very profitable from their point of view, because these creatures want to be left alone. Also, you have to understand, they consider it their Earth. They consider it their planet. A very, very interesting original Doctor Who called... can I remember it? There have been a couple of Doctor Who's with either Tom Baker or one of the others, where there was a reptilian race that lived underground. It was the Silurians, Doctor Who and the Silurians, and the humans lived on top. And one of the key comments I remember was these half-breed or these upstart apes, they referred to the humans. And somebody who's written that has had a knowledge. Someone's had some information passed to them. And that's exactly the way it is. But when the military make contact with them, from what I understand, it hasn't been very profitable.
Where in sort of history and cultures, and ancient texts particularly, and sites, even ancient sites, can we see reptilian symbolism that we should recognised?
You won't see it very clearly. One of the important things throughout all of their interaction with humanity was not to be recognised and not to be seen, because humans record in stone. We're very good at that. We create, we're fantastic like that as a race. So they recreate, and the reptilians didn't want that. You will see it occasionally in some of the Sumerian or Assyrian, Babylonian carvings occasionally. You will also see it in some of the Mayan or Aztec items. What you're much more likely to see are renditions of feline species from the Egyptian times, because they weren't covered by the same protocol. So they weren't, there was no ban on depicting them, whereas there is a ban, there still is now a ban on depicting reptilians, and I'll give you absolute proof of that when I did that very nice interview on the Today programme with Holly Willoughby and Schofield, and I did two drawings, one of a mantid and one of a reptile, and I was told point blank, we're not allowed to put the reptile up, because they were going to have me as a backdrop, them as a backdrop to me. So the stills I've got, which they very kindly sent me, I'm being interviewed with them, and behind me is a picture of the mantid. But originally, Schofield and gang were going to have the mantid and the reptile, and somebody very high up said, we're not allowed. They didn't even know what it was called. All they said to me was, we've been told we can't put this one up. So there's a blanket that goes out, and hence, if you think about what your title of this DVD is, because we're coming round to that now, and you think about that chapter in The Greatest Secret that David Icke wrote, which was don't mention the reptiles. And that's a fact, and David is absolutely right, that the system doesn't want to publicise them because they have signed an agreement not to publicise them. It's to keep them out. So you can talk about the greys as much as you want. That's not an issue. You can talk about the mantids as much as you want, because they don't manipulate humanity. The reptile race that we're talking about manipulates humanity and has done for thousands of years, and has a covenant with the elite humans who run the world that they will always be in the shadows.
In those ancient cultures, what we talk, I mean, many people talk about this, we'll use the djinn for an example. Are these the same entities, or are these, I think you've got a different opinion about who the djinn are, if that's an all you have, than some researchers, but it's still sort of along the same lines. Could you talk about a little bit about how the reptiles and the reptilians are known in ancient cultures? By what names can they be found or associated?
Well, there are some there are some researchers who believe that a group called the Archons are responsible for everything, and people get a bee in their bonnet, really. Or the djinn are responsible for everything. And the sad thing is that a lot of these people are researchers and not experiencers. And yes, I know some of them have sat around and spoken to a lot of experiences. But unless you genuinely experience, you are then, if you don't experience yourself, you are forming an opinion on other people and other people's perceptions. And my take on it is very clear, that a djinn can change into almost any shape. Absolutely. They can do that. And there are a number of experiences who I've spoken to who tell me of a tiger was in the room, or this was in the room, and I know that was a djinn. When an alien creature of any sort interacts with a human, 9 times out of 10, or 9.999 times out of 10, that human is going to be terrified of this creature. There is no long association with these creatures. They cannot appear as they look, because the human will just freak out, and whatever the purpose that they've come to that person for, they won't be able to do it. So they will come in disguise. And they don't physically change their body. They go into the mind of the human, and in the human's mind, they change. Now, because of my very long association with these creatures, they don't need to do that now. In the early days, they did, when I was a very small child. But also, it was a part of me accepting them for what they were. So as a five-year-old, or even, you know, 1963, as a three-and-a-half-year-old child, I was shown exactly what they looked like. And it did freak me out. Of course it did. But you know, if you take a child that's three and stick it on an aeroplane and fly it from, I don't know, Birmingham Airport to London Airport, by the time that kid's 10, it will go from Heathrow to JFK with no worries, because it knows no different. If these creatures don't harm you, you have no reason to be scared of them. So it means that my perceptions are going to be more accurate than somebody who's half scared out of their mind, has their body frozen and can't move. So no, there are shadow creatures that are genuinely shadow beings. There are jinn that can appear like shadow creatures. And all of the entities that we're discussing have the ability to go into a human's mind and make that human think they're seeing anything. And that's why Adolf Hitler got Dr. Mengele back in the late 30s to attempt to do work on humans that would prevent aliens from gaining control of their mind. And this is when Mengele just went completely off on his own tangent and ended up working for the Illuminati in America. But it originally stems from Hitler saying, because he was in contact with the Aldebaran off-world group, how can we have soldiers who can prevent all the information being taken out of their mind by these aliens? So that's where all this research started from. This is what totally scared the Yanks. So for most people who have an alien experience, they really don't know what they're seeing, because they can only see with their eyes and believe what's happened to them. When you have an association with these creatures, and I can't be the only one, but when you have a long association with them, you have certain agreements, and these creatures are not permitted to deceive me. And I say I'm 54 now, and I haven't lied to me yet, or I haven't caught them out yet. So they're either incredibly good liars, but when I ask a straight question, I usually get an answer, or they will refuse to answer rather than give me a lie.
And that stands for the reptilians as well?
Yes, absolutely. Very much so.
Interesting. Can you describe the various reptilian beings that you're aware of? Mary was saying yesterday that she was aware of two malevolent groups and one benevolent group. But I've heard there's more than that. But can you tell us what your research has found in your experience?
Yeah, I don't do research. I'm not a researcher. It's what I experience. And I can only tell you what I see or what's communicated to my brain. All of the reptilian groups, all of them, are somewhat negative to humanity. The bottom line for that is evolution. Reptiles don't evolve. They are the same as they were on this planet 200 million years ago. And in their arrogance, they assume that's because they've reached the pinnacle of evolution. Whereas they look at mammals and they say, you know, look at you. You are having to evolve regularly and all the time because you haven't yet reached the pinnacle of evolution. So there is this us and them attitude from all reptilians to start with. Now, when you go within that, there are those groups of reptilians who have a command and conquer attitude. So those that have a command and conquer attitude, we're talking about the main reptilians, the Draconis. They are hostile to humanity simply because they want to maintain the status quo. So there's your one group. I don't like the word malevolent because people don't understand. Alpha Draconis reptilians eat children and eat humans. But that's not malevolence. That's because it's their culture. That's what they do because they believe they have the right to do that. It's totally wrong. But that's what they believe, and they don't see it's wrong at all. And that's where they have the agreements with Earth governments. And as long as they get the supplies coming through to them, then they won't take it any further. And they don't come out onto the surface and cause a lot of aggro. And that's the way it's been for thousands of years. You've got the group that lives under subterranean caverns, who are the native group. They are the real group, if you like, because they have an association with the Earth. The Draconis reptilians have no association with the Earth whatsoever. But the subterranean group do. And I said earlier that they are ambivalent to humans. You have a very interesting group from one of the Sirius star systems of reptilians. And you have a number of genetically mixed races, which are sort of half physically reptilian and half physically of another race. They are more prone to be supportive of humanity. But generally speaking, the benevolent reptilians do not want to become hugely involved because their own sister species is the dominant one on the planet. So yes, I would agree with Mary, except I would add to it and say there are a number of other races. So I'm aware of at least six reptilian groupings or factions, but there must be more because I haven't seen everything.
They have long been associated with, and I know you've got a particular, and you've made it public, that you've got a dislike for certain great species. Can you talk about the, we'll call it an alliance, but why are they often seen working together? And actually, it's very frequent that the greys work with, they either work with them willingly or they work for them. Can you tell us about that?
I think that's a really good point. I think that's both right. They both, some work willingly and some are forced to work for them. Well, this is an in-joke, you see, with the reptilians. You won't know this. It's an in-joke because one potential outcome for humanity is to become a grey species. That's one potentiality for humanity, to end up like the greys, one timeline. So it's rather funny for the reptilians to actually be working with humanity as a grey species. That's why the reptilians hate them. They really treat them like dirt. They're useful because they are little robots. And generally speaking, they don't argue and they don't fight back, although occasionally they do. They sabotage the program, and I've mentioned that occasionally. But they're very useful to have because they're expendable. And also, if they fall into the hands of an Earth government can't learn very much from them. So they're just useful, cheap things to have. And also, as I say, there's this rather nice in-joke that you're making subservient humans. So that's with the reptilian group. However, you're more likely to see greys working with mantids than you are with reptilians, because mantids are not particularly dexterous. I was having a joke on Avalon with somebody the other day. Mantids tend to have other creatures do the small menial tasks because it's a ceremonial cultural thing. And the other thing I would say, actually, from the children's point of view, is it's less scary to see a humanoid figure that's 3 foot tall, perhaps the same size as you if you're 6 or 7 years of age, that has, broadly speaking, human proportions. Whereas it's a terrible shock to see something that's 8, 9 foot tall. And so with human children, different types of grey species will be allocated to those children that they're working with simply because it's less traumatic for the child. Because as a child grows up, it will then become more accustomed to the grey alien. The people that react badly now are those that see them as adults and either never saw them as a child or have completely forgotten that they saw them as a child. So as a very small baby, I would see grey creatures. And the thing for me was just the size of the heads. It was the size of the heads and the strange way they walk. Because during interviews, I don't like to give too much away because, in that side of it, because often when I'm at a conference, someone will come up to me, you see, and say, oh, I've seen the reptilians, or, oh, I've seen the greys. And I'll say, fine, you know, take it exactly at face value. And then during the conversation, I'll say, how many fingers have they got? Or, oh, you know, you've seen them, how do they walk? And if somebody can't show me how a particular creature should walk or how many fingers, then I begin to think, maybe you haven't quite seen them what I've seen. So a grey has a very strange way of walking, and so does the reptilian. And anybody who's really seen them knows how they walk. So you get accustomed to different creatures. I was going to use the word personality, different personalities. So when a creature comes to you, think, okay, well, I know how to act with this one. Or I know what this one's after, because, you know, certain creatures will always be used for certain things. And you begin to get a pattern of it. And I really don't like the greys. I really don't like them. You know what? There are hundreds of different versions of greys. Hundreds. You could broadly divide them into two groups, those that have a soul and those that don't have a soul. So if you think of a piloting craft that's left the mothership, it's coming to Earth, and it has maybe a crew of 4 or 5 or 6. Only the captain or the commander of that craft will have a soul. All the others will be without soul and will just be a mixture of biological elements and electronic elements. And the reason for that is when you're piloting a spacecraft, it is your DNA. You must have DNA and you must have a soul that connects with that, because the decisions you're making when you're traveling many times the speed of light, you can't physically go and press a button. That's too slow. It has to be instantaneous. And if you don't have the spark of life in you, if you don't have the soul in you, you're not capable, you cannot do that. So all commanders of spacecraft must have a soul. Even if their body is robotic, they will have a soul. So with the greys, I don't like them because they are humanity of one timeline who sold out. That's a human race on one of our timelines that sold out and became greys. So I've got no time for them because they're a disgrace to the human race. I also don't like them because those don't have a soul. You can't call them human. They have human genetic material mixed in with, as you said, reptilian or a wealth of other creatures. So they are a living life form. But if you were to define life as having a soul, then they're not alive. So I don't like them because, to me, they're just not worth wasting my time on. So, yeah, the reptilians are fantastic geneticists. So when they get a life form, they'll think, what can we do with this? And they'll do whatever they want.
It's very interesting you said that we reached that point, because Mary was telling me yesterday about a theory of hers that's still in its infancy, but she was talking about... I'm going to ask you now about what you know about my lab experiences. And I'll use Mary as a point of reference, that she was stating that some of the clients that she's had and people that she's helped have stated that in the presence of some of these beings, they can tell the difference between one of these creatures with no soul and one that has. And it typically, an experience with one of these creatures without soul is a whole lot worse and a lot more traumatic than it would normally be.
And there are two questions there. The first, I'll take it backwards. If you're going to torture somebody, it's very difficult if you've got a soul because you have a consciousness. So if you use a creature that has no soul, it can carry out orders and hurt somebody without any feeling of compunction of guilt. So that's why those are used. Because there's no soul in the creature, it is purely robotic, it carries out its instructions, and it has no karma. So it can go back home and have its cheese on toast or what have you, without any feeling of what it's just been doing. That's why those creatures are very brusque with humans, very uncaring. And the other thing that a lot of experiencers don't understand, and they get very upset about, is they say, well, it never spoke to me, it never communicated with me. And they don't understand that the reason for that is that the human was never supposed to remember. The reason these creatures don't talk to them often when during an experiment is they assume that the mind wipe that they're going to do at the end of the project means that human will forget. So that's why they don't talk to them. Of all genuine, and I really emphasise the word, genuine experiences will have had MyLab at some point, because the human governments are absolutely determined to find out what it is about individuals that makes the aliens interested in them, and they want to find out what they've seen, what they know, and it's a big game for the Earth governments to try and catch up with the aliens to see exactly who's been interacted with. I have one experience which I went public with all 3 or 4 years ago, which is 1971, where there were humans involved in what was going on, and they were dressed in white coats, they were doctors. But it wasn't their show. In other words, they were involved, but they weren't actually allowed to touch me. With most MyLab situations, true MyLab situations, the abductee will get taken to an underground base, and it's usually an underground facility, and humans, military Earth humans, with aliens in present, will deal with them, and it's often the humans that will incapacitate that individual and then do what they need to do with them. So the point about MyLab is that in some cases they're working with the aliens for the aliens' agenda, and in other cases they're working behind the aliens' back, attempting to understand what it is about these certain humans that makes them so precious to the aliens. So it's a game of espionage between the two.
I know you've been over some of this before, but what is the sort of... I know there's not a general relationship. There's various reasons for a relationship or an alliance between two species or more than two species. But particularly the mantids and the reptilians, what is that relationship fundamentally based on?
Originally fundamentally based on was the fact that the reptilians were going to come to Earth and interact with humans regardless of what anybody said or did. Unless there was a force going to come along and chuck them off, which at that time there wasn't. The mantids have an incredibly... strong attachment to the Earth and all the creatures that live on the Earth, and as a result of that, they also have enough clout not to be sidelined or pushed out. And what the Mantid said was that they would go along with some of the interactions, but they would use the connection with some of those humans for their own ends. So in other words, when the reptilians were interacting with, say 100 people, the Mantids would come in and say, those five, we want those five. We're taking them out of your program. We're going to move them across to our program. And so they would use the reptilians to act as a sort of a filtering house or a clearing house. So the reptilians could do what they wanted, providing there were certain individuals on the planet that the Mantids would say, nope. And the reason they have the clout to do that is that in the fourth dimension, the Mantid race is seen, I've often used the word, seen as the referee. So the Mantid race is the go-to man. So if you have a problem or an issue, it is the Mantid race you go to, and they've all signed a protocol that they will abide by the decision of the Mantid. So the Mantids make a decision, and that's the law, that's the rule. And when in 1971, I went through an initiation program with the Mantids, I was put through a number of tests, which were, can I make decisions? Can I make decisions, and are those the right decisions? So the arrangement is a working arrangement up to a set point, but then the two races completely split off with what they're actually doing with humanity.
When they split off, was that a mutual split off, or was there an event, was there a tipping point, shall we say?
There was a mutual splitting off. You've obviously done your homework, you've impressed me. There was a splitting off, but which was always agreed, but the tipping point is beginning of, well, the end of December 2012. As that period approached, the time frame was running out for many things, many things. And then the Mantid said, we are now at a point where we will now put phase two into operation, which they'd never discussed with anybody else. And they went into phase two. By that time, the reptilian group was so taken up with all the stuff that was going on that it didn't have the resources to say no or attempt to say no. So basically, the Mantids just been left to get on and do what they want to do.
Many researchers talk about the reptilian net. Oh, that's the name they give it. Is that an analogy for our consciousness? Sort of, we get beyond the net once we sort of become consciously aware. Or is it a physical net that stops souls sort of exiting and incarnating, reincarnating?
The machine that creates that net is physical. There is a machine or a set of machine or set of boosters which create that energetic field. A net's quite a good word. I call it the grid, but I can go with the word net. I think the net's probably better, because when we talk about the grid, I know lots of researchers get confused with the Earth's own grid. But we're talking now about an artificial grid that's generated around the planet by very, very physical machines, but create an unseen energetic field which captures any soul from leaving the planet, or nearly any soul from leaving the planet, and also prevents any soul from entering the planet, wipes that soul's memory completely clear, and then that soul is placed back into another body. Now, the reason for that is very, very simple. Let's take a great man, Albert Einstein. Imagine Albert Einstein living till he was 90, dying, reincarnating in another body, and remembering every experiment he'd ever done. Do you know, within three Albert Einstein's lifetimes, we'd be going to, you know, Jupiter and back in a bus. And so if you have a situation where you wish to keep humans under control, you cannot allow them to remember what they've done, because they will outstrip you, because humans are fantastic creatures, and they will do that. Sometimes it breaks down, and I've given a conference where I looked after John Lennon's dad's children, and as a five-year-old boy, he played for me a piano concerto, Beethoven piano concerto with no music. Now, how can a five-year-old child be a grandmaster at chess or a beautiful artist or play the piano? What's happened there is the soul that's gone into that child hasn't been completely wiped, and it has remembered. And they're called, aren't they called prodigy children, or the wonderful children? The reality, of course, is science doesn't want to face the truth, which is the soul that incarnated in that child is regaining its memory. So it's not infallible. There are people who don't get their memories completely wiped.
What is the distinction then in that case between a soul and, which is hugely important, of course, but DNA, which seems to be as important, just as important?
Right.
Well, there's been a lot of confusion amongst the New World, literally about the DNA strands. You know, the people are expecting physical DNA strands to grow within their body. And they don't understand it's an energetic strands that are growing, not a physical strand. These are energetic DNA strands, and it isn't 12, we need 13, actually. The DNA, all the DNA is a memory. It's a race memory. The memory of that individual, and this is interesting because the question that I was asked from this group who had a chat with me in Marlborough was along the lines that you're asking me. That's what their interest was. So the DNA, if it's properly hooked up, can produce pictures. It can produce a video film because the DNA is a memory. The DNA is the history of that individual, but more than that, the history of that race encapsulated. And so it's only when you regain that, you regain what you lost. And this is what people don't understand, because the human race does go back a very long time. And there are gifts that we have which need to be activated by the DNA. And once that DNA is activated, then we will have our memory and we will know who we are. And this is the whole point of ascension. You know, I never went with the New Age stuff of ascension in the sense of the word. Ascension to me is humans getting back to what they always were. And, you know, the jailers don't want the prisoners becoming greater than them. And that's what this game is all about.
Can you talk about the, I know we touched briefly on it, about the abilities that the reptilians use in order to manipulate and or control when in the presence of a human?
It depends what the human is. It depends what the role of the human is, what the job of the human is, what the sex of the human is, and whether that human has any interaction with them. If you have to understand that most reptilians will look on humans as the lowest of the low. When dealing with military, they have a first interaction protocol where the humans have to bow to them. After that, they don't have to do that because they've already shown their subservience to them. If you look at very wealthy bloodline families, the reptilians look on them as not equals, but as the anointed ones of power. So they don't have to bow generally. For instance, if a Rothschild grouping, the alien will have the reptile will have the head chair. There'll be a beautiful carved chair somewhere, and that's where he will sit, and then the family will sit round. They don't have to bow at that point, but there will be a ceremonial point where they have to do the bowing. But you're really talking to me about ordinary Joe or Josephine in the house, and the reptilian comes in. That's very rare. That's incredibly rare. Reptiles do not generally come into a house to waste their time with a human. They'll send a grey. But where a reptile does come down, it's because that individual is so important that it requires an interaction from the high level. Again, it depends on that individual. What is that person to them? What is that person to humanity? And they have, for want of a better word, time machines where they can predict ahead what each person will do. And if they see a person is a threat to them, they will attempt to come along, interact with them, and send them off on a different course. There are many, many psychic men and women on the planet who, if left to their own devices, will be incredibly beneficial. And so what the system will do is try and target a disruptive male to get involved with a female or vice versa, and to make that person's life hell. Everything and anything to make somebody not think about themselves. So it's all part and parcel of what happens. What will a reptile do? Well, a reptile will come in, and generally it won't disguise itself heavily, because if it's come to meet somebody, that person is considered important enough for them to be there. And they'll only disguise themselves to prevent that human freaking out.
One thing that I wasn't aware of, I obviously knew these intergalactic wars, if you like, for want of a better word, were occurring, but I didn't know that there's a particular relationship between the Pleiadians and the Reptilians. Can you tell me more about that?
No, it's an offshoot of the Pleiadians. I've always said publicly, the Pleiadians are actually incredibly warlike. They are incredibly warlike. They're the only humanoid species who have successfully repulsed the Reptilians. The other human species, the Lyrans or the Syrians, took an absolute beating from the Reptilians. But initially the Pleiadians did, and then really embraced war, and really believe in sacrifice. So whereas the Lyrans and the Syrians aren't into sacrifice, the Pleiadians really are. So the Pleiadians will sacrifice themselves if it takes out 10 times as many of the enemy. The point is that the Pleiadians are a human-based species. They're actually higher human than the Earth humans. We're sadly, Earth humans are the lowest rung of humanity. But that's because we're a new race, technically. So you will find there's an offshoot of the Pleiadians who do work with the Reptilians. But in any faction, there are groups that will split off through either out of choice or being forced to do it. But the vast majority of Pleiadians absolutely despise and hate the Reptilians and are in a constant war with them. And we are talking about a fragmented group of Pleiadians who were thrown out by their own government and then went and joined somebody else. So that is actually the situation. So yes, there are Pleiadians working with Reptilians, but not a large amount. Very useful for them because they're humanoid looking. So if you wanted like a Nordic, just to answer the question, if you were going to interact, what is the benefit? Because they look humans and you can gain the trust of certain people if you look human.
Absolutely. And is this sort of war, what is it? I mean, is it just old school over territory? Is this what we're talking about?
So the human outcome. It's literally whether humans will survive and develop and be what we always should have been, whether we're destined to stay exactly as we are now. Technology will change. Your mobile phone will get smaller. Your mobile phone bill will get bigger, but your mobile phone will get smaller. But humans are still prisoners. And, you know, we fool ourselves that we've gone on from the horse to the motor car and all the rest of it. But actually, we're still trapped. So this whole battle that's been fought above the earth and on the earth and under the earth and energetically through the minds of people are literally to break enslavement, because humans are enslaved. But the system has been going so long and is so clever that the vast majority of people don't understand what they are and how they're being trapped and how they're being tricked and how they're being lied to. Although they're waking up a bit now, that's why the alternative media is so successful. Just an aside, there have been two meetings now, two, in the NSA. One of them was chaired by Obama, one wasn't, where they seriously looked at banning all media except approved media. And it was a serious point. And what they were told, the technical report was that the United States of America could prevent any internet communication coming in, so they could actually blank out any alternative news company or organization in any other country to get through to them. They could, on the domestic market, completely turn everything off. The problem was the backlash. And on the two occasions where they've met, and once where Obama's had the meeting, they haven't gone down that road because of the backlash. And at the moment, they're evenly split between allowing the system to carry on or whether they just pull the plug and don't let any alternative media out at all. And that's a very real debate that's taking place in America at the moment.